Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of July. An article in the Wall Street Journal on June 15th caught our attention. It's time to cool the planet. Cutting greenhouse gases is no longer enough to deal with global warming, says Jimaeus Cascio. He argues that we also have to do something more direct and risky. The concept is called geoengineering. And our guest says that he's gone from being a skeptic to an advocate, a very reluctant advocate to be sure, but an advocate nonetheless. We're talking about geoengineering, which he says can slow the increase in temperatures and delay potentially catastrophic tipping point events, such as a disastrous melting of the Arctic permafrost, and give us time to make the changes to our economies and our societies that are necessary to end the climate disaster. Jimaeus is a senior fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He writes about the intersection and specializes in the design and creation of plausible scenarios of the future. He has worked on a number of television and film projects and has spoken about future scenarios all over the world. And we welcome phone calls for him as well. I think we'll have many of them this hour. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Jimaeus, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So in order to avoid climate disaster, you say we're going to have to start getting a lot more direct and we have to start thinking about cooling the planet. Have we thought about this for a long period of time, or is this a new thought?
Well, people have been talking about the idea of using some kind of engineering means to moderate temperatures for probably about 10, 20 years, although it's been primarily the in the realm of science fiction. People talking about putting giant mirrors up in orbit and things like that. So what in the last 4 or 5 years, however, it's moved from the realm of science fiction into something that's being seriously addressed by atmospheric chemists and climatologists and real scientists who are very concerned about just how rapidly climate change is hitting us and how slowly our political institutions seem to be responding.
Mm-hmm. You say that you were a skeptic and you have become an advocate. You're a reluctant advocate, but you are an advocate nonetheless. Tell me how your change took place.
Well, I've been looking at geoengineering concepts for about 4 years now. I was the co-founder of a website called worldchanging.com, which has become one of the biggest environmental websites around. We have book came out a couple years ago with a foreword by Al Gore. You know, definitely solid green credentials there. And I've been paying close attention to this debate. But what has changed my mind isn't so much that the science has changed, but really just watching the slow, almost resentful political dynamics, both in the U.S. and abroad, particularly in China, around the need to make really radical changes to our economy, to how we structure our cities, to the kinds of energy we produce, et cetera, the kinds of things that will be necessary to avoid a truly catastrophic climate event.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk more about the geoengineering, you do believe that we need to continue to aggressively reduce the amount of carbon that's been released in the atmosphere, right?
Oh, very much so. Very mm-hmm. much so. I'm in no way in denial about the severity of global warming or the human origins thereof or the need that we need to make really aggressive reductions to carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. And what geoengineering can do, though, you say, is to slow the increase in temperatures until we are able to make the changes, the fairly drastic changes that need to be made to our economies and our societies to really deal with different cars, different heating, et cetera, to deal with the
right
climate disaster.
Right. Geoengineering really focuses, at least the kinds of geoengineering I'm talking about and the kinds that are getting the most attention right now, really focus on moderating the symptom rather than addressing the root causes. Now, moderating the symptom rather than addressing the root cause may seem like not the best option, except when you're trying to avoid an immediate crisis. So we think about this in terms of a medical analogy. Someone who has adult onset type 2 diabetes, the real change you need to make to address the root causes has to do with changing their diet, changing their lifestyle. But they may need to take some medication to avoid a very serious near-term health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That medication won't stop the diabetes, won't cure them. But what it does is suppress the symptoms so that they have the time, they can survive long enough to make the changes to their lifestyle that would be necessary. So I'm talking about the same kind of thing for our environmental response or our response to global warming.
So this would keep us from going over the tipping point?
Right. There are a number. Well, see, here's the big thing, the big problem around global warming that makes it such a devilishly complex problem. There isn't an immediate cause and effect. It's what I sometimes call a long lag problem, because there is an extended period between a causal action and the eventual result. So we are, for example, currently experiencing the kind of the warming effects from carbon put into the atmosphere 20, 30, 40 years ago. So we could stop putting any carbon into the atmosphere right this very second, right now, and still see another several decades of warming, simply because of things like what they call thermal inertia in the oceans, because of the way the carbon cycle interacts with soil. There's all of these different big environmental processes that are actually very slow. So we may make a change to what we do, but we won't see an effect from that change for quite some time. And that means that if the longer we wait to take action, the even longer it will be before we see the necessary positive benefits to our environment. And so that means that if we look ahead and say, okay, well, we can make a good projection that we will hit a tipping point in 40 years, that doesn't mean we have 40 years to make a change. It means we have at best 10 years to make a change.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about some of these geoengineering ideas. They do seem a little bit like science fiction, but not as much as they would have, say, 10 or 20 years ago. What are the ideas?
There are still people talking about putting things into orbit, and that's actually in some ways not a bad idea, except for the fact that we simply don't have the industrial or launch capacity to do that. So let's take that one off the shelf. The one that gets the most attention right now is something called stratospheric sulfate injection, which basically means putting junk into the stratosphere about 35,000, 40,000, 50,000 feet up. Now, that sounds like a really bad thing, and in fact, that's something we've been trying to avoid. But it turns out that if you look at the results of events like volcanic eruptions, volcanoes put a lot of junk into the stratosphere, sulfur dioxide, which when they oxidize turn into sulfate particles in the stratosphere. And the effect of this, of an eruption that puts junk into the stratosphere is that there's actually a cooling effect. So when Mount Pinatubo erupted in 1991, one of the biggest volcanoes in recent history, the result, among the many results, one was that global temperatures dropped by about half a degree centigrade, about a degree Fahrenheit, for about a year, simply from all of the stuff that Mount Pinatubo put into the stratosphere. Now, you may think back in 1991, and except for people who were living around the Philippines, you really didn't see a lot of changes to the sky. You might have seen the sunsets might have been prettier. But when you're talking about putting megatons of sulfates into the stratosphere, the atmosphere is so big that it really wouldn't change our day-to-day lives. But what it would do is reduce the incoming sunlight by about 1% to 2%. And so by reducing 1% to 2% of incoming sunlight, what you do is you moderate temperatures. And so what people are talking about with stratospheric sulfate injection is artificially mimicking that one particular part of a volcanic eruption. And people who are working on this say, okay, well, we can use balloons, high-altitude balloons. We could use aircraft. We could even put sulfate particles into into aircraft fuel. And that so high-flying jumbo jets would put out this material as they fly. There are a number of different strategies around how you could do this, because it would require putting about 10 million tons of this stuff into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere.
10 million tons?
That's a lot. Which sounds like a lot, but is very doable. It's one of those things that the scale can be kind of overwhelming when you think about just how big the atmosphere is, just how much material needs to go up. But there are people who have run the numbers. The atmospheric chemists, the geoscientists who have run the numbers on this say, yeah, this is very doable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in response to the Wall Street Journal piece, aside from the hundreds of very angry emails I got from Wall Street Journal readers who were offended that the journal had published something that argued that that global warming is real, I had a few people who offered up fairly concrete plans for how this kind of stratospheric injection could take place.
Mm-hmm. You also write in the piece, though, about environmental side effects of this kind of procedure.
Yes.
Can you outline those, please?
Yeah, the two biggest ones that I think are most relevant for people. One is that, the first is that we know from the effect from volcanoes that the presence of large amounts of sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere damages the ozone layer. And this is something that we've been fighting against. And so if we were to undertake this kind of process, we would have to figure out ways to mitigate that particular bit of environmental damage. The atmospheric chemists that I've spoken to about this are fairly confident that there are ways of doing so. So they are cautious but not overly concerned about that one. There is the question of what happens to the sulfate particles as they precipitate out of the stratosphere. Sulfur dioxide is correlated with, of course, acid rain. The people I spoke to about this are think that there are ways of avoiding that particular problem. They haven't shown me the numbers on that one, so I still raise that flag as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem, really, is that once you start undertaking this kind of large-scale manipulation of the environment, you set in motion processes that you have to continue doing until you've cured the carbon problem. Because it turns out that, and this has come up in a number of different models of this process, that once you start the sulfate injection, if you stop abruptly, global temperatures actually spike back up.
Oh.
And they actually spike up higher than where they would have otherwise before coming back down to continue their previous pre-geoengineering path. So that only happens if you stop abruptly and haven't been making the changes to your carbon emissions. But what this says is this is not something that you can do haphazardly, you know, and sort of say, well, maybe we will, maybe we won't. It's a decision that once made, you got to continue. But as I think I mentioned in the article, as scary as some of the environmental effects might be, the real threat, the real challenge around geoengineering comes from its political impact.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the other idea here, though, which seems just on its surface to be perhaps less environmentally dangerous, and that's to use ships to propel seawater thousands of feet in the air that would form or increase cloud cover.
This is something that has less of a clear natural mimetic. It's less clearly based on natural processes that we can see and observe elsewhere, but it's based on a pretty well grounded understanding of how clouds form and the effect of clouds on the environment. And this is basically these kinds of ships, and forgive me, I'm still wrapping my head around precisely how they work. But essentially, they use wind power generators, big rotor generators, to pull seawater up and just shoot it high into the air.
Ah.
And the sea salt forms a crystal of essentially cloud raindrops. And it's basic cloud formation 101. And the idea here, and this is, again, there are a couple of scientists who are working really hard on this particular model, and they make a very persuasive case that if you have a few thousand of these ships out there, and again, this is talking about scale, is just a few thousand of these ships out in the, primarily in the northern parts of the oceans, what you do is you increase cloud cover, you increase the brightness of clouds, thereby reflecting more sunlight. Because this is both the stratospheric sulfate injection and the increase in cloud cover have the same goal of reflecting, of bouncing back a small percentage of more sunlight in order to moderate temperatures. Now, the big drawback or the big question about the cloud brightening process is what they tend to refer it, how they tend to refer to it. The big question about cloud brightening is, will this work the way the models show? Because there isn't a natural process that we're emulating, we're less certain about what kinds of side effects might emerge. Now, they're both sulfate injection and cloud brightening, because they change temperatures, have the very likely effect of changing global rainfall patterns. One of the studies suggested by a Dr. Alan Robock, R-O-B-O-C-K, suggested that there's a very high likelihood that at least some approaches to stratospheric sulfate injection would decrease monsoonal rains in South Asia. Now, we think about monsoons, you think about these massive flooding events, but really monsoonal rains are very important for the agricultural cycle in South Asia. And so any disruption to the monsoonal rain cycle could be really devastating to the ability of countries in South Asia to feed themselves.
We're going to pause for just a moment and return. Obviously, there are concerns about both these types of geoengineering, and we will address those. But I want to get to your phone calls because our lines are humming here. We do have one line opened if you'd like to get it right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. And our guest has written a piece that appeared in the June 15th Wall Street Journal. Demaeus Cascio is with us, senior fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And we'll be with you in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now, starting with John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hey. Hi there. Oh, where do I begin? I don't disagree that the global warming issue is real. I think it's disgusting what we're doing to our planet, and we are definitely not good stewards. But I just keep thinking, like, this approach, this radical, spraying the environment with this sulfate, it's so similar to the industry of cancer, where, there's cutting, there's surgeries, there's poisoning. And that's what I feel like this is going to be, is, it's a false ray of hope, and we have no idea what that's going to do to our planet. It doesn't sound feasible, and I just think it's going to be like a Band-Aid where people are going to say, oh, well, they're going to do this, so why should we, be conservative or do other things, to get at the root? Because, like you said, this does not get at the root, and, this is a huge gamble with our lives. So my vote is no.
Jimmy's.
Well, I think that doing it or not doing it, is a big gamble with our lives. I don't talk about the possibility of undertaking geoengineering lightly. I don't talk about it because I think it will be an easy way out. I think it's incredibly risky. I think you're right that there are enormous unanticipated potential for enormous unanticipated consequences. And yet, I look at what the science shows about what is happening to the planet if we don't address this problem immediately. There is increasing evidence that we're looking at the onset of some serious zoonotic pandemic diseases, basically diseases coming from animals. There's good evidence that these basically become more prevalent during periods of climate instability, environmental instability. There are issues around, we're now looking at the likelihood of hundreds of millions of climate refugees and the corresponding tensions and likelihood of war when you talk about that kind of mass movement of people and mass demands for increasingly limited resources. I'm looking at what happens when you have meters of sea level increases around the world, when you know that over 50% of the planet's population lives within 100 miles of a coastline. I'm looking at the impacts in terms of deaths from heat. I'm looking at the impacts of drought, the impacts of just all of these kinds of directly attributable to climate disruption disasters that come from us not acting. And then I look at what's happening in the political world about, we have this enormous debate over cap and trade in the U.S., and this will barely scratch the surface of what needs to be done. I've spoken to people in the political leadership in China about this, and there's still such reluctance to act because they're afraid that it will, in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term, damage their economy. And I just see time and again an inability of our global leadership to recognize the severity and the scale of this crisis. And you know, it seems to me that we have forced ourselves into the corner of having to choose between the unpalatable and the unconscionable. You know, the something like geoengineering, which is really a bad idea, and you know, between that and less letting things go, which would be fatal for so many millions of people around this planet.
Thanks, John, for your call. Mike from Appleton is next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, boy, it sounds like tinkering with nature to me, and that sounds really scary and really dangerous. However, if we have to do something, instead of pumping things into the atmosphere, of which we have absolutely no idea what the end result will be, and once it's done, it's done, why don't we go towards more reflective capacity? I mean, basically, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to reflect the sun's rays away from us. Mm-hmm. So instead of pumping stuff up there, why don't we do something down here, which conceivably we could turn on and off, like painting roofs or, you know, figuring out some way of getting sheets of white plastic spread over the desert so we have reflective capability, which if we see it doesn't start to work, you know, we can roll it up real quickly.
Well, just one thing about the stuff being pumped into the stratosphere, it actually cycles out in the course of a few months. So it's not a case where it's up there and it's up there permanently. It does cycle out. The suggestion about painting rooftops white is actually a very good one. Art Rosenfeld, who's the head of the California Energy Commission and is a scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories, he and his team actually put out a paper about a decade ago, looking at the impact of painting rooftops white. And it turns out that in really hot climates like Los Angeles, you actually have a better energy impact result from painting rooftops white than you would by putting standard solar cells or solar panels on rooftops because of how much cooler buildings get when you reflect that much heat or that much heat and light. But when you run the numbers, even if you were to have widespread painting of rooftops white, it still wouldn't be enough to reflect that 2%, that 1% to 2% of incoming sunlight. So let's put white plastic in the deserts. That's really becomes a question of how much do you value the desert ecosystems? Because doing that would be pretty devastating to desert ecosystems. And so all of these have trade-offs. All of these have trade-offs. If they're good enough to work, they're going to have some other kinds of consequences. And I don't want to come across as saying that this is a perfect solution. It's not. But it's something that... This is a debate we need to have now because we're getting very close to the point where even if we undertake geoengineering, it's too late.
Mm-hmm. You've also talked in the article about maybe just doing intervention in the polar regions, which you say would be enough to hold off the most critical tipping point events.
Right. Yeah, the people who are looking at what kinds of nearer-term crises that we may face because of global warming tend to focus on what's happening at the poles, particularly the North Pole. And that's because we have quite a bit of methane. Methane trapped in the permafrost in northern Siberia, northern Canada. And it turns out that methane is another carbon-based gas. It's naturally occurring, and it has a global warming impact of, depending on how you run the numbers, between 25 and 75 times worse than carbon dioxide. That is, for the same volume of methane, you have 25 to 75 more percent more 25 to 75 times more global warming impact than you would if that was CO2. And so there turns out there's something on the order of 70 gigatons of methane trapped under the permafrost. The result, if that permafrost were to melt, and it's already starting to melt, would be essentially on the order of a century's worth of global CO2 emissions coming out over the course of a few months.
Hmm.
And that really would be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that if you look back over geological history, there are periods of mass extinctions that seem to correlate with massive methane eruptions. This is something that we simply cannot abide. This is a civilization-ending event, if it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of focus on what's happening to the permafrost areas. And so the idea, what I talk about in the article, is if we could focus the cooling or the reflection on the polar regions to keep that permafrost from melting, to keep the Arctic from melting, and that would help, by the way, in keeping Greenland from melting so quickly. And it wouldn't slow the warming globally, but it would help to delay these kinds of really catastrophic events.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Frank from Madison is next. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's a fine, well-informed, and cogent guest. I think that I'm probably joining the chorus here, but hacking the planet is something that is attractive in the sense that we're facing a really an emergency, and the intelligent and relevant response of rapidly decreasing the CO2 emissions, which is driving the warming of the planet, doesn't seem to be happening. But to advocate hacking is perhaps no more likely to succeed or as likely to succeed as a policy initiative as let's dramatically get off a petroleum coal-based economy. And offering it as an alternative may allow the clean coal people to continue for the next 20 years, where ultimately we've accumulated the additional CO2 that means we've built in the disaster. But I've observed that engineers often have brilliant, direct, and feasible solutions to problems which create additional problems. So do you think that you're pessimistic? So you're about the prospects of reducing CO2, and so hacking is necessary rather than perhaps just an option. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
I'm not sure if I would describe myself as pessimistic, but I'm very, very worried. And I'm also someone that I really... The idea of, through inaction, allowing what could be tens of millions of people to die just strikes me as horribly unethical. That's horribly unethical. And therefore, we put ourselves in a position of having to choose between some very unpalatable choices. My sense of what's happening, one thing to note about the political difficulties, the difficulties in getting something like a geoengineering project going, as you rightly note, would be, you know, there's some massive hurdles to get over in order to make something like that happen. It's worth noting that the industrial capacity required to undertake something like the stratospheric sulfate injection or the cloud brightening, it doesn't require a planet to do so. It's something that, if necessary, a country even the size of France could do by itself. Germany could do by itself. Japan could do by itself. You can sort of go down the list of nations that are, you know, reasonably post-industrial, have a reasonable size economy, and realize that they have the capacity to undertake something like this. Now, doing it alone would have just some enormous political repercussions, and I'm in no way am I advocating that. But what I'm saying is that unlike the carbon reduction strategy, which again remains necessary, it doesn't require everyone to take part in order for it to work. So with regards to carbon reduction, even if the United States were to have an epiphany and the James Inhofs of the world or of the Senate sort of, you know, suddenly gain some rationality, there, and the United States were to act immediately to take enormous transformation, and we get Europe and Japan to go along with us, unless China and India also join in, it doesn't matter. If China were to suddenly become evangelists for carbon reduction and the U.S. didn't join in, it wouldn't be enough. It's something that carbon reductions require the entire industrial, post-industrial world to take immediate action, and in order for it to have the kind of effect that we'd want. And that just doesn't seem to be happening.
Wouldn't geoengineering, though, also require all countries on Earth to agree to this, and then you'd have to figure out who's going to administer this, et cetera? How would you put those rules in place?
Geoengineering would politically require widespread agreement. It wouldn't require, in the technical sense, widespread agreement. The point I made a moment ago, that unlike carbon emission reductions, you could have a subset of the world community engaging in geoengineering and still have a measurable impact. But it's the political dilemmas are pretty profound for this. And as much as I say that the environmental issues are, you know, need to be kept in mind, it's the political political dilemmas around this that I think may end up being the bigger problem.
And what are those?
Well, as you suggest, there's the question of what happens when you have disagreement among countries about the wisdom of engaging in something like this. There's a question of how would you administer it. But really, there's also these questions of what would be your target? How much cooler do you want to make the planet? So you can easily imagine a scenario where Russia, which is already, you know, the Russian leadership has already said, you know, made comments along the lines of this kind of global warming is just fine for them. The Russian leadership not wanting to see a significant reduction in temperatures, while at the same time leadership in, say, India, want to see a much more significant reduction in temperatures simply to avoid really, you know, catastrophic results, you know, for India. So that debate over targets can become a big one. There's also the small but not dismissible chance that these kinds of climate engineering technologies could be used for strategic purposes. That is, if the U.S. develops these kinds of tools and it turns out that you can target certain areas to have, you know, more significant changes to temperature, more significant changes to rainfall patterns, et cetera, would it be something that becomes another kind of arms race?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the questions around control, around targets, also around liability. So if you start to do something like this and you do see big changes to monsoonal rain patterns in South Asia, you can make the you can draw connections between the two events, but you can't make a categorical this, you know, this caused that. You can't make a categorical causal argument. Certainly not one that would hold up in court. And yet, there will be all these questions around who's to blame, who should pay, who's liable in the case of negative results from this kind of activity.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Jimaeus Cascio, Senior Fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Engineering Technologies, author of a very intriguing piece, June 15th issue of the Wall Street Journal. It's time to cool the planet. Cutting greenhouse gases is no longer enough to deal with global warming. And he talks about, at some length, the concept of geoengineering, which is what we're discussing this hour. Thank you, Frank, very much for your call, as always. And we have one line open. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Jack from Madison. Hello, Jack.
Hi. Yes, I don't think that this is really appropriate because I don't think the scientists have all filed in on exactly what's happening with our climate. The climate changes hither and yon through the eons, here and there. It goes up, it goes down. And it's very arrogant for these people to say that they know what the future of our climate is going to be based on a model which really hasn't been tested. And apparently the government has been spraying the atmosphere for years without telling anyone about it. And I wonder if your guest knows anything about
that. Spraying the atmosphere with what?
There are chemtrails that are being laced throughout the atmosphere. You can see them most of the time just looking up. Do you recall that when you were younger, the clouds, the tails of the airplanes never spread out the way they do today? I certainly do because I remember.
Mm-hmm. Jimaeus.
Where to begin? I'm not going to address the chemtrails stuff because... You know, that's all signs are that's urban legend, but whatever. With regards to climate science, the models have been tested for decades. The science is extremely rigorous around everything from the effect of carbon on as a greenhouse gas to the anthropogenic or the human sources for the CO2. Your caller is correct that climate changes hither and yon, I think was his phrasing, over the course of geologic history. That doesn't rule out the potential for human activity to add to it. And when you start looking at the actual geologic record of the amount of carbon, CO2 in the atmosphere, and if you look at, and here's actually a little piece of science that not a lot of people know about, but is very persuasive for people who are paying attention. The ratio of different isotopes of carbon 12, carbon 13, carbon 14, in the atmosphere started to change about 200 years ago, about the time of the onset of the Industrial Revolution, and it moved from you take the carbon out of the different bubbles in the ice cores and such. What you see is that the CO2 in the atmosphere increasingly started to look like they have the same kind of proportion of those three isotopes of carbon as you find in coal. And so it's a very logical argument to say that the reason that you had this increase in this new balance of isotopes is that from all the burning of coal pumped into the atmosphere. And if you look at the fluctuations of temperature, the fluctuations of carbon, you see very consistent patterns. And so what we're seeing starting about 200 years ago, increasingly to a point where about 50 years ago it started to really spike, is a radical divergence from historical patterns. The notion that the science isn't settled on this is a myth.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that the science is uncertain around human sources for climate change is, to say it's a myth is to be polite, because there are a lot of people out there who simply refuse to look at the science because it undermines their worldview, because it undermines their economic interests, because it offends them that there are certain, that they have to make some changes, they'll have to make some changes in their lives.
Yeah.
And so if I'm having something of an aggressive pushback against what your caller was saying, it has nothing to do with your caller, and so I hope that you're not taking this personally. It's just that the fact of these of climate denial proponents, you know, the climate denialists, their impact on the political process has been disproportionate and profound, and may end up being one of the key reasons why the U.S. has not acted nearly quickly enough.
Mm-hmm. Kurt from Madison, our next caller, Jimenez. Hi, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Good morning. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I've got a question, and then if I have the time, a follow-up question. But one of the questions I was always intrigued with is there any means of technology-wise of placing heat pumps in the major ocean current lanes to transfer that energy, since the ocean is such a large heat sink itself?
There actually has been some work on that idea. What I've seen of it has been, the results have been inconclusive, but the larger conclusion seems to be that the potential to do that at a scale enough to change the atmospheric temperature is really out of our industrial capacity at the moment. It's basically the same kind of scale as putting mirrors into orbit.
I see. And may I ask a second question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, the other question is there anything in the study that does a crunches the numbers on CO2 output of greatly reducing the amount of semis off the road and transferring that freight to rail cars?
The transportation in the U.S. as a whole is about a third of our overall carbon footprint. And so that includes both personal transportation and commercial transportation. So the idea of transferring freight from semis to trains would, let's just say for the sake of argument, if we could potentially reduce our overall carbon output by about a sixth. So definitely measurable, but not enough to make a difference in and of itself.
All right, thanks much.
Thank you very much for your call. We go next to Joe from Ellison Bay. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good.
Good.
I just wanted to, you know, comment that I feel like jumping into something like geoengineering when we're so far into reducing our pollution and we're coming up with such great technology, and then getting into, as he said, the legal battles and then the potential for all the harm that it could possibly do, it seems like a lot of unnecessary risks and a lot of time and distraction, and it seems like we might start to be kind of pulled apart from, you know, in the all different areas trying to do different things, and that will lead to less development in those areas. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I think that's a legitimate question. That will an increased emphasis on geoengineering pull attention and resources away from doing what needs to be done around reducing carbon? I am inclined not to think so, based on the work that I've done in terms of you know, consulting with governments, consulting with companies, with different communities and nonprofits, for a couple of reasons. The first is that there is such potential for taboo around the discussion of geoengineering that I suspect that you have a lot of people who are just going to avoid wanting to get involved with that simply to avoid the controversy. More importantly, the trigger for geoengineering will undoubtedly be increased evidence of the catastrophic impact of climate disruption. That is another Katrina, another mass heat wave in Europe that, you know, killing tens of thousands of people. Something that crystallizes the recognition that we have a big crisis to deal with, a great crisis to deal with. And in that context, my interpretation of political action, you know, the patterns of political action, is that what you see is a growth of the pie rather than a further slicing of the pie. That you have more people interested, more money going into, more interest and resources going into dealing with this crisis, and in that context, having a percentage of that go to geoengineering. And it really wouldn't need to be a large percentage of the overall resources going into dealing with the climate. Having that percentage go to geoengineering would not be not result in an overall degradation of our capacity to deal with carbon. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Joe? Thanks.
Thanks very much
for the call. Let's go next to Richard from Fish Creek. Hi, Richard.
Hi. A proposal that doesn't involve trade-offs is to gather CO2 from ammonia and hydrogen plants, and up to 20 million metric tons per day can be gathered that way and transported in LP tankers if it's kept below 65 degrees below zero at 800 so many pounds pressure per square inch. And this would be a beneficiary from the oil and gas industry, because they're set up to do this, and then that would encourage hydrogen production. It can be transported to the Arctic in liquid form and reconfigured into dry ice and put into cooling towers, and there would be a low-grade cooling effect while the dry ice is kept in storage, and also electricity can be produced as a byproduct, and so it's a clean system in which there's a net economic benefit in the electrical production, as well as the infrastructure that is created, and the tax credits, et cetera. And as this stuff is gathered and more cooling towers are produced, that emits colder air in the areas of the polar ice.
Well, I've heard of bits and pieces of that plan. I have at different stages of development and study. I haven't heard of someone putting together in that way. Definitely would like to learn more. So, is there a URL or an address that I could?
I have a fax number, 920-839-1455.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Steve from Minnesota. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
Appreciate the good debate here. You know, I think our expert hit it on the head earlier, where this is more of a political problem than anything else. And the reality is the politics will probably never align throughout the world to get enough agreement to make any difference. So what we're seeing, and our expert already touched on this, is Mother Nature is taking it into her own hands by creating drought, starvation, you know, climate disruption, as it's been called. And like many things in the past, the Earth is regulate itself and reduce the number of people to reduce the problem of carbon. And the Earth will survive and possibly will end up like every other species that is come and gone.
That's actually something that's worth emphasizing, really, that a lot of people, when they talk about environmentalism, they think of it in terms of loving the planet. And, you know, loving the planet's fine, but environmentalism is all about loving our civilization, believing that our civilization is worth maintaining. And that requires us to be good stewards of the planet, certainly much better stewards of it than we have been, not because it's this kind of woo-woo hippie, it's all great and green for Mother Earth, but because it is critical. Our civilization depends upon the viability of our single fragile home planet, and I think it's really worth emphasizing that when I talk about these processes, whether or not we end up going with geoengineering, when I talk about the need to deal with global warming, when environmentalists all over the world, when they talk about the need to make changes to how we live and how we act and how we think about what we do, it's not because we dislike people. It's not because we dislike our civilization. It's because we love our civilization, our global civilization, and want to see it continue.
Jimenez, thank you so much for being with us. Interesting hour. Jimenez Cascio, the piece is in the June 15th Wall Street Journal, if you'd like to take a look at all of it. And we thank him for being our guest this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the hour. And thanks to Jalema Noel for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 on the Ideas Network.